Thanks, Eckert. Thanks for the organizers for having me. This is an informal presentation. I learned that yesterday. Therefore, I informally changed the title. I informally changed all the slides. Because the idea is obviously to raise more questions than what I can answer. And the idea is to not finish all the 100 slides I have, but more like engage in debate, discussions, and violent oppositions. Everything is welcome. So one of the things I did was I changed the topic because a lot of questions yesterday revolved around modeling these flows and mathematical modeling and choosing appropriate numerical methods are part of the game. And also that's why I wanted to take a broader look than just turbidity currents, because later talk's going to talk about sand particles, saltation, and dunes, and so on and so forth. There are a variety of natural flows happen in the context of particle laden flows. Therefore, I wanted to first talk about the first three bullets are mainly about mathematical models and numerical methods and so on and so forth. Because yesterday, Eckert gave a fantastic talk that showed the wonderful variety of physics that are displayed even in the context of turbidity currents. So I really like physics, and I want to talk about this. But today, at least the first part of the talk, I want to talk about modeling. And I want to talk about issues such as scales and scaling analysis. Also, I want to talk a little bit about one of the areas that I worked on, the equilibrium Eulerian approximation. But then, time permitting, I will talk about microscale investigations, which go towards microscale simulations of a flow around individuals and clusters of particles, particularly talking about their drag forces, lift forces, and talk about resuspension mechanisms and modeling. And also, I want to talk about a different aspect of physics concerning turbidity currents, where the suspended particles, on one hand, drive the flow, but on the other hand, damp the flow through stable stratification. And we have explored that physics. And this kind of physics, this interaction plays a very important role in turbidity currents, where they lead to massive sudden depositions. Whereas in the case of air-water interface, a lot of sea spray has been known to damp the exchange of momentum and energy between the water and the air under hurricane conditions, because hurricane intensities have been always a problem to model. And we are working on seawater interaction. And also in the context of wave-driven suspension, this interaction plays an important role. So I will talk more about those things. So that's the plan for today. So I want to start with a provocative title, not to take anything from wonderful things that Eckert shown yesterday. There's a lot of physics and the problem is very complicated. But turbidity currents in the spectrum of particle-laden flows, both in nature and in an industrial application, is somewhat, we are fortunate that it is an easier problem in terms of mathematical modeling because it's fairly dilute for the most part. So I like to think of the so-called undisturbed spectrum. For an industrial or an engineering flow, this is very well defined because imagine you have a slurry flow or a pipe flow with suspended particles. The turbulence exists even without the particles. So you can think of a undisturbed spectra, and you can think of how big are the particles compared to this undisturbed spectra. Whereas in the context of, say, a turbidity current, the whole flow doesn't exist if the particles weren't there. So One good way to think of undisturbed spectra is, now don't think of particles as being point masses or something like that, but think of it as a second fluid or the same kind of density difference or buoyancy effect coming through by salt or by temperature difference, in which case you can easily think of a turbulence in that turbidity current. The question is, if the particles are significantly smaller than the smallest relevant scales, which are the Kolmogorov scale, then one has an easy situation that there is a significant scale separation. Clearly, there are going to be scales of motion, fluid motion, on the order of the particle size, but that's a direct effect of the particles and their wake. Creating this new piece of spectra. But the particles collectively also alter the even the larger scale motions, which is the spectra with the particles. So in some sense, the effect of the particles is over the entire range of scales. But nevertheless, since the particles are much smaller than the main spectra of turbulence, these kind of flows are much more amenable to modeling and simulation. So one way to think of this is you have the microscale, which are sort of scales of the order of particles or interparticle spacing. So there's a lot of physics that goes on at the microscale. But here you can talk about a mesoscale or a system level scale, a macro scale, where you do not have to resolve the individual particles, and you can just focus on simulating meso and macro scale. So in some sense, when Eckert talked about direct numerical simulations, they are direct numerical simulations at the meso scale, but they are clearly not direct numerical simulations at the micro scale, since the physics around each particle is not modeled. But the effect of all the micro scale has been embedded in the macro scale simulations through buoyancy terms. So, but you know, depending on problem, you might have to modify the viscosity or the diffusivity of the particles, like we argued yesterday, comes from the micro scale physics, can give you a lot of information that needs to be embedded in your mesoscale simulations. Yes?
Can you give us a typical value of the Kolmogorov scale in an atmospheric boundary layer or a typical Serapius event?
Yeah, I did anticipate that question. So yesterday I did some back of the envelope calculation. Let's imagine that you have a 10 meter high turbidity current. With say a density difference of just 1%, okay? So you can vary the particle density and volume fraction such a way that, let's say that there is only 1% density difference. Such a current, its velocity will be roughly around 1 meter per second. So you calculate the Reynolds number, the bulk Reynolds number, that's what Eckert presented yesterday, will come around 10 to the power of 7. So 10 meters, 1 meter per second, and viscosity of water gives you a Reynolds number of 10 power 7. Now, you can calculate the Kolmogorov scale for such large scale motion comes around 60 microns, okay? Because Kolmogorov scale divided by the integral scale goes as 1 over Reynolds number to the power 3/4. So if you do simple calculation, you can calculate this point should be around 60 microns, and the energy containing eddies will be of the order of 10 meters. So you can see there is a 5 orders of magnitude length scale variation. Although at these smaller scales, you do not have a whole lot of energy. Now, if particles are sub micron, 10 micron, then you can consider them to be smaller than the Kolmogorov scale. But if you do have sand particles, 100 microns, 200 microns, they start interacting with your main Kolmogorov scale eddies. But of course, when you're doing a large eddy simulation and your simulation starts from 10 meters down to, say, 1/10 of a meter, then these particles are much smaller than your result scale. But they're still bigger than the Kolmogorov scale.
So from a simulation point of view, you're using this separation, as long as your grid size is bigger than your particles.
But it's a little more complicated than that. As I will tell you, even though your particle could be smaller than your resolved scales, the fact that they are bigger than the Kolmogorov scale makes these particles participate in a much more complicated way. For example, when you have this kind of a very simple situation using simple scaling arguments, you can show that since the particles are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale, their Reynolds numbers are guaranteed to be less than 1, and their Stokes numbers are also bounded. Okay. Whereas when these particles start entering this regime, so for example, in the example I gave, if the particle is 300 microns size, then it's bigger than the Kolmogorov scale, its Reynolds number could be hundreds, and the Stokes number could be much larger. Therefore, their inertial effects as well as their finite Reynolds numbers become an issue.
I think there are quite some people here who are interested in this regime, I guess. And so anything you can say about that?
That is why I put this, I put this up. And we can discuss, yeah. But this regime, like I pointed out, that even in this regime, when particles are very small, it makes modeling much easier because particles are so small. Their effects don't need to be explicitly computed. You can use two-fluid kind of approach here. But there's a lot of very interesting physics in this regime. So
what are typical Stokes numbers in that regime? What are typical Stokes numbers in that regime? You say Stokes is contained, but what is the maximum?
I didn't explicitly calculate. The Stokes number, depending on particle size, could be very small or very large. Now, Stokes number is a slightly harder number to define because it's a ratio of particle timescale to fluid timescale. Now, what fluid timescale that you want to compute, whether it's based on Kolmogorov timescale or is it due to the large eddy timescale? I will say a little bit more in my next few slides about Stokes number, but I don't have a precise value. The key point is that as the particles are getting bigger, the Stokes number gets larger. Now, one of the things I was very interested in is given varying particle size, can we estimate even before you go to the computer what kind of Reynolds number we anticipate and what kind of Stokes number we anticipate? So that was the scaling analysis result I'm going to show. Yes?
What do you mean by no trajectory crossing?
That means the particle's velocities are uniquely determined in terms of the fluid velocity. So when the Stokes number is small, the particles are all their inertial effect is basically very small. That particle velocity is uniquely dictated by the local fluid velocity. Again, I will say more about this in the coming slides. So imagine that particles are injected from the top and bottom walls in a sort of a flow in a channel. If the particles remember where they are coming from, then somewhere in the middle, there are some particles will be going up, some particles will be going down. So there is a non-uniqueness involved. So when you are doing a simulation and you call one particle velocity, which velocity, average velocity? So lots of interesting questions come when you have inertial effect of particles that come into play.
So no collisions. No collisions.
Collisions will increase because of the inertial. So. Yeah, even without collision, say, collision may depend on volume fraction. You could have a situation, large inertia, low volume fraction, where particles in that volume don't collide, but some of them go one way, others go the other way. So there could be a distribution of particle velocities inside your cell. So the harder problem is when particle size is smack in the inside your spectra, then there is a much more complex problem. This is what I would call a finite size effect, where the spectrum of turbulence very strongly interacts with the wake behind the particles. What makes this problem much more complicated, like I said earlier, is that the Reynolds number for such particles is can be significant. In fact, when the Reynolds number of the particle exceeds a few hundred, these particles create wakes and they put in a lot of energy into the flow. So imagine a situation you have a still fluid and you're dropping somewhat bigger particles, and the inertia of the particles is such that the Reynolds number of these particles is about a few hundred. Then all of them are not going to come down straight. They are going to go various directions. So there's going to be a dispersion, mainly due to the wake generated behind these particles. So from a turbulence perspective, it makes the problem very complicated, because on one hand, the self-induced turbulence itself can create particle dispersion, enhanced dispersion. On the other hand, the particles can modify your turbulence. So when you're doing an LES simulation, it is not just the particles are responding to the ambient turbulence. Particles actively generate and put in turbulence. So you might have to, in your closure models, have to take into account the particle-generated turbulence and the stochastic motion of particles, or stochastic effect of dispersion of particles, due to the finite size and the wakes. Yeah.
But if I'm not interested in all the very detailed motions of the particles, but just in basically the overall motion of the flow, mm-hmm. In a situation like this where the particle size is not much larger than the Kolmogorov scale, wouldn't it be sufficient to basically change a few of the parameters, like the settling velocity or so, and still get the overall behavior of the flow with the usual ways?
Yeah, so additional physics has to be incorporated into your models. So this is where I was coming. You know, when you have a larger simulation and you decide to only simulate these range of scales, these particles are now subgrid scale. So yes, you do not have to explicitly account for these particles and flow around them, but the modeling aspect gets more complicated. This goes to your question as well as Jim's question earlier, that this is not as straightforward in terms of modeling as the previous case where there was a clear scale separation. I mean, this is the classic problem of not having a clear scale separation. Now, when you want to model, say, large eddy simulations here, the subgrid scale closures, like I said, have to know that there is turbulence created by the particles itself. Again, going back to this problem, there is no external turbulence and you're dropping a lot of spheres and they're coming down. How are you going to simulate that? All the physics is now in particle generated turbulence. So if you don't model that, you've thrown the baby with the bathwater. So it depends on the nature of the problem that this new physics comes into play, and also the interaction between the particles now create dispersion effects and so on and so forth. They need to be modeled. Both the effect of the fluid on the particles as well as particles' effect on the fluid have to incorporate these additional physics that come into play when there is scale overlap.
Another question. Yeah. Your previous slide, you made a distinction, between scales, and you mentioned the turbidity current. This is also a turbidity current.
If you had a flow which is driven by fine particles and the shear stress is big enough to suspend sand-like particles in there, it could be. But in other cases, when you have only fine particles, maybe then there is a nice clean scale separation and you can model it just with simpler set of equations. Yeah. Yes?
Just to be clear. So the dissipation processes that you are taking into account here, viscous, but also collisional effects in the particles?
I'm not explicitly talking about collisional effect. Even without collisional effect, there is a lot of other things going on. Here there are great experts in collisional effects, so I'm not going to say anything about collisional effects. But collisional effect, if the volume fraction happens to be large, adds more wrinkles to the modeling and simulation efforts. Okay, this is even without collisional effect, just by the inertial effect of the particles. So collisional effect, there is one knob, which is volume fraction. I have tuned it down to a fairly small value. So even for low volume fraction, there are a lot of interesting additional things that can happen when your particle inertia is large.
So that, So there is an additional dissipation due to viscous effects on the particles due to the inertia. So because they are moving with respect to the fluid, they are going to be viscous.
That's right. There is drag forces and there is dissipation. And what does turbulence do to the drag forces? Does it settle at the standard Stokes velocity, or there is enhanced settling velocity? So a whole lot of questions that come about in, if you take a simpler model and there are certain parameters that are being used, so settling velocity, you have diffusion coefficient for the particles, and viscosity. Now the question comes is that all these things are correctly modeled or not in this context. Now when you go to LES, now LES closure parameters are involved. Again, I ask the questions, are they modeled for this regime?
Is it because things are happening at the subgrid scale, mm-hmm. does that mean that we're not, in our modeling, not distinguishing between the particle and fluid velocities, except perhaps in a settling velocity?
No. So in this context, when your particles are much smaller than the resolved scales, maybe one can say, I'm going to use a Eulerian representation for the particles. Okay, that's all we are allowed to do in some sense. Now, that velocity need not be the same as the fluid velocity, and that velocity need not be just the fluid velocity plus the settling velocity. One needs to really ask questions, what is? So you need to have, like, start with the two fluid model where you have momentum energy equation for the fluid and momentum energy equation for the solid phase and work from there, okay?
But it would be useful, I think, to have the kind of models that Eckert is working with placed in that context.
I am going to do that. I'm going to do that if I can get away from slide number 3 and more. Then I will get there. But this is great. This is very, some of the questions, this is why I put all these slides, because based on yesterday's discussion, we can have lively debate here. Yes.
Make it a bit more challenging for you to get away from slide number 3. Maybe to make these questions that we had a bit more concrete, I ask another question, which is in a similar spirit. I mean, if the particles are very much smaller than the Kolmogorov scale, we have a formula going back to the PhD thesis of Albert Einstein, where he says that the viscosity increases by a universal, a very dilute particle content, it increases by the universal term 5 over 2 times the volume fraction. Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that for a turbulent flow where the particles are bigger than the Kolmogorov scale? Is there any
analog? No, we don't.
So there is not such a thing, because it's not so universal. Or is there not such a thing because nobody has tried? Or what is the status there, roughly speaking?
Yeah.
Just to get an idea of where we are.
This finite size particle effect, this is an open question ripe for more research in terms of modeling. It is a very, very complicated. If you go to multi-phase flow literature, people are beginning to understand only now how to even have a sort of a continuum representation for these particles in the context of, say, large eddy simulation. And questions like, what would I use for effective viscosity is a great question. Yeah.
How would the eddy viscosity be increased by the presence of...
Like I said, I have more...
There's not a formula for this. So.
Yeah. I don't have answers, I have more questions. Okay, like that.
So I can still give other PhD thesis with this topic to find the answer to any question for...
Next three slides I have taken from some other problem, so all the numbers are wrong, okay? But I just wanted to say the following, is that what we're dealing with a multi-scale problem, that was very clear. So there is a range of turbulent scales, There's a range of particle size, and there are instabilities in other problems happen. So here, all I wanted to say is that we are dealing with a wide range of length and time scales. The one way I find it very convenient to think about is to separate the problem into three scales, a micro scale, a meso scale, and a macro scale. The micro scale is, all these things are very loosely defined. Micro scale is the physics that happens over individuals and small clusters of particles, and clusters of particles become important because volume fraction will begin to play a role, because the drag forces on these particles can change if they are close to each other, for example, okay? Now, that kind of a microscale information, if you're not going to account for in your simulation, its effect must be incorporated into any mesoscale simulation models. But mesoscale,
I was just wondering, these order of magnitude statements that you have there, which quantity do they refer to?
These are number of particles. So a point I wanted to say is that we know how to do direct numerical simulations resolving particles. And today, if the particle Reynolds numbers extend into if they are several hundred, then with today's computer petascale machines, you can go up to 10,000 particles or maybe more and resolve them and do honest DNS simulations at the micro scale. And that is something you can call really DNS because you're well resolved, but you gotta impose a certain mesoscale condition for these micro scale simulations. Now, at the mesoscale simulation, we abandon resolving individual particles. So we either use a Lagrangian approach where you treat them as individual particles, you probably will talk about that, or you can use a two-fluid model that you just describe a continuum velocity field and a number density field and so on and so forth you could do, but then such an approach does not resolve the microscale, so all the microscale physics must be appropriately incorporated into your mesoscale approach. Now, when there is scale separation, that incorporation becomes relatively easy. When the scales are overlapping, then it's still an open question how best to incorporate this microscale information into your mesoscale. Now, obviously, when you're doing a turbidity current that's happening on a field scale, when you're having thousands or hundreds of kilometers, then even turbulence will not be resolved. I'm talking about mesoscale turbulence will not be resolved. So the best you can do is a large eddy simulation of some sort. There, you not only are not resolving individual particles and the physics associated with the individual or clusters of particles, but you are missing a lot of instabilities, perhaps that I put this instability because in this example that I was showing to other people, there were some instabilities in the mesoscale. For us, what it would mean is that at the macro scale, even the wide range of turbulent scales will not be resolved. So one needs to have LES models. But the interesting thing is that the micro scale physics that feeds into the mesoscale may even change the mesoscale closure that you want to use in your macro scale. In other words, what I'm talking about that if you want to have a LES closure, now we are talking about a multi-phase flow LES closure. So it's not readily apparent that you could just use the single phase LES closures that people use and incorporate them into your large eddy simulation models at will. Because, like I said, if the particles are inertial, then they bring new physics into play. So LES closures, there are a lot of open questions when you're talking in the context of finite size inertial particles. So in some sense, again, saying the same thing again, you can study the problem at the micro scale, you can do it at the mesoscale, or probably for engineering or the industrial, the oil companies may do simulations at the macro scale, but there is a continuum flow of information through point particle models or drag laws, viscosity closures, and so on and so forth. Micro scale simulations can inform your mesoscale, and you can have LES closures and so on and so forth from the mesoscale to the macro scale. This is not relevant, thankfully, for our problem, but I was interested in shock flow, very extreme shock flows going over packed bed of particles and so on and so forth. There, even atomistic scale processes will tell us what are the equations of state, thermodynamic and transport properties different. But fortunately for us, we can just live in the natural flows in the continuum scale modeling and simulation. So now I want to sort of go and talk a little bit about scaling. Very, very simple arguments I'm going to present. But what I want to drive at is that can we guess a little bit, make an estimate on what Reynolds numbers for particles that we anticipate given a flow condition and particle parameters? And then can we also estimate the Stokes number? So to do that, we want to use the properties of turbulence and properties of the particle. For turbulence, just classic turbulence arguments, let's assume an eddy of size L and the local dissipation rate of epsilon. So immediately you can write in terms of epsilon and L, the eddy's velocity, time scale, and acceleration scale. And for the particle, you have only two parameters that are of importance, which is the density ratio. And the particle time scale is the time scale at which time over which, when you drop it, it reaches its terminal velocity. And then for finite size particles, this time will depend on Reynolds number as well, because Stokes drag is not appropriate anymore. This is basically correction to the Stokes drag because of finite Reynolds number. So these are the only five quantities I'm going to be playing with.
Not so fast. We couldn't read that in this time.
Yeah, no, that's
what. What's the energy dissipation rate? You define it as energy per second, or is it defined as more like a velocity squared in your time per second?
Well, basically velocity.
From the mass somehow, or?
Yeah, from here you can see it is basically velocity cubed divided by length.
Yeah, okay.
It's a bachelor's, very standard definition. So one of the things I'm going to later talk about equilibrium expansion. So what we do is that basically we take the Lagrangian equation of motion for the particle. And only approximation is that we say the Stokes number is small, okay? So you can expand, you can basically solve the equation of motion exactly for as an expansion in the Stokes number. And this is the kind of expansion terms you get. So particle velocity is to the leading order the same as local fluid velocity. It deviates from the fluid velocity because of inertia. So tau p is the Stokes number. So this is the density parameter. Rho is the density ratio that I defined in the previous slide. So this basically the a function of ratio between particle to surrounding fluid density. And this is the acceleration, local fluid acceleration. What this says is very simple things. If due to some pressure gradient, fluid locally is accelerating, a particle is unable to accelerate just as the fluid, and therefore going to give rise to a difference in velocity between the local fluid and the local particle. Okay. So instead of this, you can substitute G. So if I put G in there, this term is nothing but settling velocity. Okay. So
you can motivate this from the particle equation of motion, but you can also regard it as a sort of general tensor expansion, yep, the particle thing. Yep. So yep, it's easy to add on extra terms and yep, measure them if you need to. But
well, one only thing is that this, you can derive this rigorously from yeah, the equation of motion, but it is so physics, there is plenty of physics in that that you can even put it down in a intuitive manner. Yeah, and people have done that.
I'm not quite getting the idea. I mean, this first term I can identify, but according to my understanding, all the higher terms are not allowed unless you take them all into account, all meaning up to infinity. Any single next correction to that would be inconsistent, as far as I understand from the Burnett
Well, but this is not from, this is not using the Fermat, but there's the particle equation.
Equation of motion.
And it will have to an asymptotic expansion to get the other terms.
So I'm going to.
The other terms are singular, aren't they?
No, they are not singular.
Not in this case.
No.
In this case. No. So you think you can make a Taylor expansion here in a way, in terms
well,
of higher orders of the derivative,
it.
Time derivative?
Well, no, you can think of it as a Taylor expansion, but also you can think of it. You know, if you want to take the second order terms, what are all the vector quantities I can form out of the fluid velocity strain field?
Yeah. So he's talking about invariant representations. Basically, you have a tensor, or depending upon some other tensor,
that's fine.
You can. But I think it comes out that way. You could do that. But for an equation of motion, this is just an exact solution to your equation of motion. I'm going to talk about that as well. So
if you drop the higher order terms. Yes, I can believe it, but if you take a finite number of higher order terms, I'm not sure. I mean, the higher order terms will have higher derivatives in time, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. So in fact, they are not just derivatives in time, they are also derivatives in space,
exactly.
They're total derivative. In fact, we have computed, and I will refer to our papers, where we take the second order term. The improvement is not a whole lot. So this leading order correction itself does a very good job.
That just gets another point about this. The Stokes number is assumed to be based on the steady expression for the drag.
No, it doesn't.
Well, what is the definition of the Stokes number, if not based
can,
on?
I will get to that here. This is only one eddy. Therefore, the Stokes number is a ratio of this to this.
Yeah, but that the drag term in the denominator is a steady drag.
Yes, in this case.
Well, is that appropriate if the situation around the particle is changing rather rapidly? That is, you've taken into account the rate of change explicitly, but I'm saying there may be a rate of change that appears in the drag formula as well.
Here, what we are talking about this. So this expansion is valid only for small Stokes number. So which means the particles are responding to the flow field. Okay.
In a way that's given by a steady drag formula.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean, this is a point we will go and look at it, because this is, we derive this from a unsteady force equation. So in other words, so what happens?
I'm afraid you've used your definition of the Stokes parameter without regarding the unsteadiness that may appear.
No, the equation is unsteady equations. So we just define this based on that. So in other words, this is just comes out of the non-dimensionalization of the equation. So we take the full unsteady equations of motion. I mean, there is a limitation to this because I'm assuming the particles to be small Stokes number, and therefore they are responding to the ambient flow in some ways. In other words, this is not a ballistics trajectory, so this won't apply to a baseball thrown into air. So the implicit assumption is that now particles are slaving. So I will say more about this equilibrium Eulerian approximation. Maybe I have some slides on that, so we can revisit that, okay?
I was just wondering, shouldn't it be the ratio of tau p over tau l there?
This is sloppy notation right now.
Okay.
I just wanted to get some other point I want to talk about, but I will get to equilibrium Eulerian. Justification of this equation, shoot me down maybe 5 slides later, but hold your fire right now. Because I just wanted to get to a scaling argument right now, okay? But then I will justify this in a few slides later, yes.
Expressions for the leading order inertial correction have been used by many people in the past, notably Maxey.
This is
so is this exactly the same as Maxey's formula?
Maxey was my advisor, so,
yeah.
So this is Maxey's relation. See, the Maxey wrote this. Only thing is that what we are saying is that we apply this as a expression for the particle velocity field. So
yeah.
Maxey wrote this, so, and this expansion, this correction, Maxey correctly showed that it's able to capture preferential accumulation, turbo forces, and a lot of physics is embedded in this this correction.
So, could it be for first order term?
Am I correct in assuming that tau p can be varying over time?
Oh, yeah.
But
not really. I mean, here the way I have thought of this is that this is a non-dimensional parameter that will come out of your problem. Okay.
It's dimension 4 here. Here
it
has dimensions of time in your.
Exactly. Opinion. That's why I said that to Eckert's question, this is sloppy notation right now, but we will clean it up.
Okay, we're looking forward.
It was suitable for the time being right now. Okay. So in the paper, it's posed in a more cleaner way now. So the main point that I wanted to make is that if we say that the particle to fluid time scale, if the Stokes number is small. So here I'm really using the ratio. When the ratio is small, then you could express the relative velocity in this fashion. So bottom line is that the scaling argument is very simple. If the Stokes number of a particle is small relative to a certain eddy, then it's responding to that eddy, so I know the relative velocity. And implicit in this is that the relative acceleration is zero. Okay. Now, if the particle Stokes number is large, then the particle is not responding to the eddy, and therefore the velocity difference will be capped by the eddy velocity, and the relative acceleration is capped by the eddy acceleration. Okay, very simple idea. So with that, you can say when you have a range of turbulent scales, you can think of, based on this Stokes number, particle timescale to Kolmogorov timescale, you can define three different regimes of particles. A particle that is responding to all the eddies from the Kolmogorov to the integral scales, its relative velocity scaled by the Kolmogorov velocity will exhibit a linear dependence. Whereas you can define a regime three where particles are, in terms of Stokes number, so large that they do not respond to any of the eddies, and therefore their relative velocity will be capped by the eddy turbulent velocity scale. Intermediate, you will have a regime where particles respond to larger eddies but not to smaller eddies. Therefore, in the intermediate regime, you get a half power law connecting these two regimes.
Okay. Which has been known for a very long time, I think. Which has been known for a very long time.
Yes. We just.
Not early in 2009. An astrophysicist called Phillips, for example, had it in 1980, I think.
Okay, well, give me the references. So, what we do is that once you have the relative velocity, that allows you to calculate Reynolds number. So here you can estimate the Reynolds number of the particle. Only three parameters play a role: relative size, density ratio, and the turbulence Reynolds number, which is a ratio of the integral to Kolmogorov length scale. So you can just this last parameter is not that it does not play a very crucial role. So what I've done here is plot as a function of particle size and the density ratio, the likely Reynolds number. So this is where I was talking about, is that when particles are sufficiently smaller than the Kolmogorov scale, the Reynolds number of the particle is guaranteed to be low. But when particles get larger than the Kolmogorov scale, even if you're doing an LES, the actual Reynolds number of the particle for this free-moving particle could be substantial. When the Reynolds number of the particle is large, then there are processes such as vortex shedding and so on and so forth in the wake of the particle.
I didn't understand exactly how you make it plot. So what's that?
So I just used this information. Okay. This is the relative velocity scaling. And I just do some juggling and then out comes this result. I am skipping all the details, but the thing is that very simple argument, scaling argument.
It's not a simulation.
It's not a simulation. It's just back of the envelope kind of calculation gives you this. Same thing you can do for Stokes number also. So here, particle time scale to Kolmogorov time scale. The parameters are particle size and the density ratio. So this is bubbles in water, whereas this is more like sand particles in air, or somewhere in between you have sand particles in water. So for various cases, you can calculate what is the likely Stokes number based on Kolmogorov scale. But if you know the turbulence, you can also calculate Stokes number based on your integral scale eddies. The Stokes number will be the biggest. This will be the biggest Stokes number based on the Kolmogorov eddies, because the time scale of the Kolmogorov eddy is the smallest time scale in the turbulent flow. Again, I try to distinguish if you are doing a real DNS of the flow, then by that we want the particle size to be at least 10 times smaller than the Kolmogorov scale in order to be able to use point particle approximation or use a second fluid kind of approach. Whereas if you use LES simulation, and if your smallest resolved eddy is 10 times or 100 times bigger than the Kolmogorov scale, just try to play different scenarios and to see what kind of Stokes numbers can we expect in the context of particles in DNS simulations or point particles in the LES context. You can clearly see that in the context of LES, clearly the Stokes number of these particles can be large.
Okay. The points you plotted on both sides look identical to each other.
They are the same, just this line is the difference.
So you've labeled one DNS, you've labeled the other LES. That suggests that they should be two different things.
No, I just wanted to draw this line and see these data, because they don't depend on the simulation. These curves are exactly the same, just for helping our eyes, I drew this line and this line. They are one and the same information. You're right. This does not take into account the scaling analysis, doesn't know your longitudinal simulation or anything. It just gives you what's your Stokes number at the ratio of particle time scale to Kolmogorov time scale. Okay? So I just ask the question, so if I were to do a DNS, what kind of Stokes number I will see. So if I were to do a DNS and all the particle to Kolmogorov scale happens to be less, this is the kind of Stokes number that I expect in my DNS where I put fine particles which are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale. Whereas if we are doing a large eddy simulation where the resolved scale is 100 times bigger than the Kolmogorov scale, this is just an example, and I drew the line here, and particles, I can have particles 10 times smaller than the resolved scale. So you can see what kind of Stokes number that we expect to see. So in some sense, if we do a LES where the cutoff length scale is 100 times the Kolmogorov scale and the particle size happens to be 1/10 of the cutoff length scales, which is 10 times the Kolmogorov scale, you can see in case of sand particles in air, the Stokes number can be 100.
So that's an example for what you said before, that the subgrid modeling that you need could be different for the DNS and the LES.
Absolutely.
Because for the LES, the Stokes number is very big already for
train
your model and for the DNS.
So the same point I made, just I'm making a little bit more quantitatively here, is that if the particles are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale, Reynolds number is small, Stokes number is small, we're in very good shape. Whereas when you're doing really field scale simulations where your Reynolds number of the real flow is large, so you're doing a DNS simulation, your cutoff length is bigger than the particle, but the particle could be bigger than the Kolmogorov scale, and you got to worry about these things in those contexts. So in terms of Stokes number, as the Stokes number increases, you really want to think about different approaches of simulation. When the Stokes number is very small, and of course there is another parameter alpha is the volume fraction. All the discussion I'm making is for very small volume fraction. When the volume fraction becomes larger, collisional effect and other things that need to be accounted for, so I'm not talking about them. So this is dilute case, but even in the dilute case, the one of the parameters that plays a very important role is the Stokes number. When Stokes number is very, very small, one might as well take a dusty gas or an extended dusty gas approach where simply particle velocity or velocity particle velocity field is fluid velocity field plus a settling velocity, and that is what turbidity current simulations typically use. But when the Stokes number becomes large, then particles do not necessarily respond to the same way as local fluid elements respond to acceleration or pressure gradients. So one might get away with something like an equilibrium Eulerian or the expansion that I showed. And the Stokes number gets even larger, then really one needs to use Eulerian approach. When Stokes number becomes larger than even one, then non-uniqueness of velocity comes into play, crossing trajectories and things like that come into play. So either one needs to, then if they use a Eulerian kind of formulation, two-fluid formulation, that velocity in some sense implicitly represents an average value, average over the velocity in the phase space, or one needs to use a Lagrangian approach. And of course, really large, which means particles are very big, then maybe only option is a fully resolved context. But fortunately, most of the applications will fall in this regime, so one can use the easiest approach that can be allowed given a certain Stokes number.
What does Eulerian mean? I mean, is that, I don't understand. We're talking about the modeling of the particle phase?
This is Eulerian. So in other words, Eulerian, I meant Eulerian or two-fluid kind of approach, okay? But only thing is that here, one needs to solve separate momentum equation for the particulate phase and separate momentum equation for the gas phase or the liquid phase, continuum phase, and then got to couple them through momentum and energy transfer.
And why does that fail then? Why is a different approach necessary?
Here? In the Eulerian approach, at least the standard two-fluid approach, you have an equation for the particulate phase, which sort of says that all the particles in a tiny controlled volume of some sort at a time all have the same velocity, okay? But if the Stokes number is large, when inertial effect is important, then all the particles in that subvolume do not necessarily have a unique velocity. There is a distribution of velocities possible. So either one needs to use a probabilistic description to account for the particle having multiple velocities at the same location and same time, or if we use a standard Eulerian two-fluid kind of model, then that velocity now represents an average value. So there's a closure terms will be involved because fluctuations about that average velocity will have to be accounted for in your.
But couldn't you simply use an Eulerian analog to the modeling similar to a K epsilon model for a fluid? I mean, it seems to me there are Eulerian approaches.
Yes, there are. All I'm saying is that all those things, fundamentally, since particles can have multiple velocities, something needs to be done. So there will be closure issues if you use a single velocity.
I just don't see that those closure issues are different from those that arise in pure fluid turbulence.
Yes. This will be like subgrid scale modeling in some sense. So you could use closure relations to bring them in, take into account. Yeah.
But they are not available.
Hmm?
They are not available yet.
Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah, so the, like you said, there are terms available, but these are modeling issues, so more modeling issues will come into play. When you are dealing with small Stokes number, then you don't have to worry about those modeling terms. And those modeling terms become important, and people have worked on these closure relations. It makes the problem harder. I'm just alluding to some of these issues.
And if I can just chime in here, I do think there's a fundamental difference between the particles and the fluids, because when you think about closure assumptions for just a pure fluid, you can still think of all quantities as being just a function of space and time. Whereas when you have inertial particles, then you can no longer think of things in those terms. The particle properties are no longer a unique function of space and time, simply because the particles have inertia, so you can have particles coming from different directions, coming to the same point and having different velocities, so the particle velocity is no longer a unique function of space and time. So I think that's what makes it much more difficult.
And it seems to me there's an analog there. If you think of turbulence, and turbulence averaging is arising from ensembles, where at a typical point in space, you have then many fluid velocities corresponding to the different realizations. So I don't know that they're so different.
I tend to think of it more in the falling form. When you have inertial particles, then you need to look at it almost more from the point of view of an effective Boltzmann equation, where you're always looking at a distribution of particles, now not just in the three spatial coordinates and time, but also three velocity coordinates. So you have to essentially analyze the problem. If you wanted to start from first principles, you have to analyze the problem in phase space.
Yeah, but from the Boltzmann equation, you can always derive a hydrodynamic equation again.
That's what you do under certain assumptions. Yes.
Yeah, but the granular people have worked to some of these models terms. But the collisional term for a particulate stuff, my understanding is that can be different, substantially different from that from the fluids because of the inertial behavior of the particles.
May I ask a question from my understanding? Hermann Clark's talk. Your talk.
Yes.
Is it here in this where it says Lagrangian? Was that basically the problem, how you treated it with the... Is that here in this...
We treated it Lagrangian, yes.
So, yeah. And so would you say what you discussed was in this corner up here where the Lagrangian is?
Yes, ranging yes. From, say, 0.1 and 2.10.
Okay, yes. so that's somehow...
You see, what I was trying to... what I was thinking about is that if we don't worry about collisions, like I said that I'm restricting myself to fairly small volume fraction, when you do a Lagrangian simulation, you don't have this problem because naturally wherever these particles come, that's where that velocity is. Mm-hmm. So if we are going to do a Eulerian representation for the particles and we're going to simulate, then there is this question of what happens when the Stokes number becomes large and there is a non-uniqueness. How do we handle that in the context of in the context of then obviously there is additional modeling terms are involved in the particle momentum equations and so on and so forth, coming from sort of averaging process, if, which is implicit when you write a single velocity.
Your way of looking at this is basically a fluid dynamics point of view. You're not, I mean, the granular people might go the other way around and say we have lots of particles and then we have some interstitial fluid. We start from the granular mechanics and then see what the fluid does to the granular mechanics. You are definitely on the other side.
On the other side, yeah. So that's why I said most of what I'm talking about is low volume fraction. So I'm looking forward to what so others are doing in the dense regime, where you could even ignore the fluid. Probably there's a range of models like this, ignoring the fluid, accounting for the fluid, and so on and so forth.
It's a question of what the intruder is, whether it's a fluid or a grain.
See, the one of the difficulty in the shock particle bread example that I talked about, which I am not presenting, is that exactly, you know, it starts being in the regime of dense particle regime, and then it eventually becomes very dilute. So there's now a very big question as to, and that's what I'm hoping to gain much more understanding and interaction while I'm here, because most of my life I've spent in this regime, and there is another world out there where people start thinking about volitional effect dominating, and then the fluid in between playing a very minor role. But there are problems where it goes from one regime to the other regime, and how do we have a unified model? So one simulation framework which will do everything is of great interest. Yeah.
Just one small question for my comprehension. Does the gas, does that mean you're basically treating it as a fluid?
Yeah.
And modify a little bit the density or something like that?
Each of these things, I'm going to throw some governing equations. They're not precise. So this is what, Jim, you talked about, is that where do we put the equation that we use for turbidity currents in this continuum of models?
Can I please?
Yeah.
Just to understand, but when you say about the difference between dilute and dense, would we be the same if you are dealing with a low Reynolds number or high Reynolds number?
Reynolds number of the particle or the global flow? What Reynolds number are you
of
talking
the particles.
Of the particle. So that doesn't depend on volume fraction. That's what I was trying to say. It only depends on the size of the particle compared to your turbulent eddy scales. Your Kolmogorov scale and your particle size are the thing. Now, like he pointed out, all these things, the viewpoint is more like you have a gas or a liquid and a somewhat of a dilute dispersion of particles in there. Now, when you have a lot of particles and they are colliding, maybe some of these thought process may not be appropriate.
But in fact, I mean, the axis on the left here, the Stokes number, mm-hmm. is usually very closely related to the Reynolds number. Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
well, that
sometimes it's the same. Yeah?
No, not really.
The ratio of the density.
Yeah. So basically, there are two parameters: relative size of the particle compared to Kolmogorov scale, and density ratio. And the third parameter is how intense your turbulence is. What the range of scales that you're having. With those things, you can pin both those quantities.
Yeah.
That's the main point. Okay.
But if you fix one quantity, then they often go together.
Exactly.
The particle Reynolds number and the Stokes number. In that sense, maybe also your question is answered, I guess. Yeah. It's in here.
So, some equation, what kind of models are in the dusty gas. When they're extremely small, they just move with the fluid. All you have to do is solve the concentration equation, and then you have a continuous phase for the gas or the liquid. You have a standard Navier-Stokes equation. Of course, it's very simple, so it's very good when your Stokes number is very small and volume fraction is small. And then in turbidity current, what we use is what I would call a extended dusty gas approach, where we say that the settling velocity plays an important role. Therefore, particle velocity is simply given by local fluid velocity plus a settling velocity. So we just have to solve the volume fraction or number density equation, and then solve the continuous phase equations. Now, I want to point out that in general, if the volume fraction are the fact that particles occupy a certain volume and fluid occupies only the volume outside, one needs to solve a more complex sort of a continuity equation. But if volume fraction is extremely small, then obviously divergence of u equal to zero. That's what typically simulations use. But the particles can have, when volume fraction increases to a few percent, can have a volume fraction effect. So your more complete model would be this. And of course, there is also an inertial effect in this. So by assuming Busenek's model, this variation in density, the inertial effect is ignored. So most of the turbidity current simulations will use divergence of velocity to be zero, and this will be taken to be the ambient density. Only here the density of the suspended sediments will play a role, and that the Busenek's approximation on top of all these other approximations will be involved. And that's what I would call a extended dusty gas framework.
Is the continuous phase meant to be the mixture, or is it meant to be the pure fluid? It's a mixture, is it not?
No.
Here I'm talking, you could write it as a mixture equation also, but here I just I've written as what are the governing equations for the particulate phase and what are the governing equations for the continuous phase. Okay, and of course you can combine them and have a mixture phase equation. So for a mixture phase, what you will have is divergence of mixture average velocity will be zero. Okay, so you can define a UC which is alpha CU plus alpha DV. So you can add these two equations, and then that gives you a divergence of the mixture velocity to be zero. So that you, if you want divergence free condition, that would be one way to get it.
Okay.
But if you have this is what being solved, the consistent and correct formulation is this. Okay? But then you go through one more level of approximation to say, let me just say that alpha C is small, that this is equal to divergence of U equal to zero, which means you are avoiding so in other words, if divergence of particles is large, then you are violating locally mass conservation to some extent. In fact, what I'm doing is that really, the way to derive this is to derive here and then make simplifications and come here, but I'm presenting it the other way. I'm showing the simplest equation. I'm sort of building complexity and making it more complicated. Now, again, I haven't shown the derivation, so if the Stokes number is large, the key point I'm trying to make is you can use this expansion where, again, particle velocity field is explicitly given. You don't have to solve a momentum equation. So particle velocity field is the fluid velocity, local fluid velocity, plus the settling velocity, plus the fact that the particles do not respond to the local turbulence, local acceleration. And then again, you have to solve the concentration equation for the particles, and then these two are the same as before. Again, I have a couple of papers which show what this additional term does in terms of capturing a preferential accumulation of particles, basically vortex spinning out of vortices and so on and so forth, how these efforts can be built in. Okay. Again, this is as simple as the previous approach, but it just makes the computation a little bit more complicated. Yes?
Sorry. Didn't you say before that the settling velocity could be included in this term in the Taylor term?
Here?
So I think that before you said that the settling velocity is also included in this tau v 1 minus beta term.
In this term?
Yeah. That also includes acceleration.
If you have no fluid motion and just particle settling, how would this term come into here?
U is the fluid velocity.
Acceleration
acts on the particle, not on the fluid.
Yeah, but when you introduced that term previously, there wasn't a gravitational term, there wasn't a settling term, so.
Just for simplification,
I
in the paper I have considered the gravity effect as well. I just wanted to show the simple scaling argument without gravity effect.
And beta is some complicated expression that comes out of the specific this, consideration.
This one? Yeah, I will come to that derivation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
At this point, so at some point it becomes important to distinguish the mass average velocity field and volume average velocity field and whether it's actually divergence free. So at this point, are you assuming that U for the fluid is divergence free?
U in the momentum equation is divergence free.
This is not divergence free.
No, but for the U, the fluid, well.
No, fluid velocity satisfies this equation.
No, but you're missing, there has to be another equation. That's not enough on its own.
No, there's no need for any more equations. So you have alpha equation for the dispersed phase.
Okay, there has to be a relationship between alpha D and alpha C there.
But they add up to one.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. There is another equation. That yeah. No, he's right. Technically, I mean, I have alpha D and alpha C. So they need to add up to one. So if particles are even bigger, if the Stokes number gets larger, then one needs to solve a set of equations for the particles and set of equations for the continuous phase with the momentum coupling between those phases, the drag forces, and so on and so forth. I mean, there are a lot of people, so many papers on this, these kind of two fluid models. And then the previous slides, I just knocked off terms by calling some approximations. But if the inertial effect of particles is large, then one needs to sort of simulate these kind of
So
fluidized bed people, there are a lot of communities.
Yeah. In the second equation, you mean that
should be V.
Yes, sorry.
And we'd expect that the interaction terms of the previous slides were, in some sense, approximations to the momentum balance.
That's right. This equation was solved in an asymptotic sense, and we get this explicit expression for it. So in other words, I need to justify how this comes from an equation of this form. Now this equation, again, for a particle, you write it in a Lagrangian form and do some sort of an average to represent it in an Eulerian framework. So that averaging, multi-phase flow community has worked on these kind of averages, volume average, ensemble average. There's a wide literature on obtaining these equations. And of course, those averaging causes additional terms and so on and so forth. So I have skipped all those details. Prosperity, Ishii, there's an industry which does these equations.
An interesting question might be, how much do you really gain by going from the previous slide to this slide? I mean, I see that this is a richer set of equations, but the question is, how large is the
benefit.
How many phenomena are not well described by the previous one, but still well described by this one? That would be an interesting
very good question. I will give you some examples that I think of. But clearly,
it's not an empty set. Okay.
Yeah, it's not an empty set, okay. But that set may not be that big because this is one of the things we also argued. What we argued was, when we started using this formulation, we asked exactly the same question. This is for small Stokes number, and this can also be used only for small Stokes number. So what do we really gain out of that was the question. And therefore, we have used this formalism in a number of different simulations. But one example I will tell you is that the key question is, does particle respond to local acceleration of the fluid, and is this sufficient enough? Imagine there is a shock wave going over a particle, just immediately downstream of the particle. Since the shock time scale is zero, so as to speak, there is a region of equilibration. So the particle coming out of the shock, while the gas moves very fast, the particles move zero, and there is a distance over which particle have to accelerate and catch up. In those kind of scenarios, this does make a difference. Okay. But like I said, that there's a
shock.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to be certain I understand. Are you saying that for small particles and small Stokes numbers, the second equation may not add too much?
No, this goes back to our earlier discussion. So this should be V.
Yeah.
even the fact that you say that there is a unique V that exists, okay, for that, that Stokes number of the particle has to be small, okay? For such small Stokes number particle, wouldn't it be sufficient to just use this and avoid simulating another set of momentum equation for the particle? I believe that's what his question was.
But isn't that a set of momentum equation? Isn't that a momentum equation for the average velocity of the particles?
This one you...
No, this is the next slide.
Yeah. If you treat it as an average velocity, then I need to add some closure terms in there, like we discussed. Then this can extend to even larger Stokes number particles. Then there may be a bigger range of application. But as I have written here, I did not do any averaging locally, okay, the way I've written. So I thought of only a unique velocity existing for the particulate field. But you can extend this formalism and say, yeah, there is crossing trajectories, but let me treat a average velocity.
I still don't understand this issue of crossing trajectories. I mean, that may come from a computational perspective, but why can't I regard V as the local average velocity of the particle phase?
Yeah. So by average, that means you have average. So then I have nonlinear terms here. So you start with some Lagrangian equations of motion for the particle, and I'm applying an average, right? So there's a nonlinear term. And if all the nonlinear terms are...
Why do I have to start with Lagrangian equations of motion for the particle? Particles are flowing in a similar way that the fluids are flowing.
But
you have a small cell, and you have particles coming from different directions. And at a certain time, they're in that cell, and you want to make an average. That will not tell you that particles will go in different ways at the next instant. So that is that a point?
That's right.
There's nothing to do with the Lagrangian.
Let me try.
If you want to make an average, then you will lose.
No, the point is coarse graining, Jim. I mean, if you write down this Eulerian equations, you always coarse grain the velocity. It's not the velocity of a particle, it's a field. And in this step of coarse graining, if the velocities over which you coarse grain are largely different, then you have an average velocity plus a fluctuation term.
Will not this equation apply to the average velocity?
With an additional term. With an additional term for closure.
You have a fluctuation term.
Reynolds stress-like term will be there.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's a fusion term.
But I don't know how to close that equation. That's all I'm saying.
You don't know how to, what you don't know?
The Reynolds stress term needs to be then modeled in terms of the known averages.
That's fine.
The closure problem exists.
That's fine.
Okay.
I just want to...
That could be done. Right?
Yeah.
But the idea, let's see, the idea that, well, what do we do for large particles and large Stokes numbers?
If this
equation, works for almost all cases, we're finished.
I agree.
If we add a term.
I mean, when particles are small and the Stokes number is small, then this is rigorous.
I agree, that's fine.
I'm not saying that we cannot simulate bigger particles. I'm just saying that when you do those things, there is a closure issue involved.
But it seems to me you'll find it, in answer to Klaus's question, that in fact this equation seems to work pretty well, even for larger particles and even for larger Stokes numbers. I mean, I don't think so.
Yeah. Well. Works well means, I mean, that's where the thing. What do you mean by, I mean, there is a closure term.
And what then about rocks and water flowing down a mountain? That's large particles and large Stokes numbers. And I wouldn't go back to the previous slide and attempt to describe it using that.
Actually, I think there you might have a problem, because at the front of the degree flows, you get the large flocks amassing at the front of the degree flow because they are inverse grading and they're moved to the front. And then the fluid, the water, is just flowing out of this area, and then they start stopping. Then you really are, I think then you are at a loss with that kind of equation, and you really have to go to a...
Well, actually, we modeled that using two-phase equations. I mean, we certainly have other terms that require to
take care of the fluctuations, but in fact that front, we've taken care of the fluid particle front. So you can do it.
So the Lagrangian, so when particles get bigger, you have Lagrangian approach and the other approach. Of course, there are advantages and disadvantages, whether you use Lagrangian approach, point particle approach, or Lorentz approach. We have used both of them, and I want to say next half hour, or whatever time. Please tell me when I should stop. I have covered one third of my talk.
Well, we need to make a decision. Either we should break for lunch now and continue a bit later, or maybe we should.
Can I just finish this one?
No,
just
I would say
five
let's
more
go at 12:30.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Okay. Because we have another talk this afternoon.
At 4.
That's yeah.
Right, yes. So okay. So we'll go to 12:30, and then we'll see where we are at that point to see where we can fit in more.
And we could also schedule kind of mini discussions on these various topics. That is, it doesn't have to be all of us together for 50 minutes.
Yeah, interested so parties could.
And then we put them up on the wiki so people can.
So this goes back to, again, we discussed this. If I describe a particle velocity field, then I have to think of this as a unique velocity or as an average velocity, one of those two. Okay. If it is such a way that particle inertia is large, and within a fluid volume, if particles are going to have different velocities, then the approaches are you either do a Lagrangian tracking or do a probabilistic representation. Our average velocity, but if you use the average velocity, then we discussed that there are closure terms that will appear. So what we have done is that if we restrict ourselves to small Stokes number and therefore limit ourselves to a unique particle velocity, so this is wrong, this should be particle velocity. Then the interesting thing is that in a turbulent flow, that unique velocity, though it is can be uniquely defined, it doesn't have to be the same as u. We can solve the equation of motion and get v in terms of u. In other words, particle velocity is slaving to the local turbulent flow. Okay, so v can be expressed as an expansion in u and its spatial and temporal derivatives. So that the idea is pretty simple. So if you take a complicated unsteady equation of motion for the particle, so this is not a steady structure. So basically this is mass times acceleration is a bunch of forces. In this non-dimensionalization, this is the Stokes drag. You can have a finite Reynolds number correction if you want. Effect of gravity, Bassett term, pressure gradient. You can have whatever you want, lift forces, whatever you want to have. This is the Lagrangian equation of motion. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the way I'm thinking of it that this is, if you were to do a fully resolved simulation and you were to track the particle, the particle's motion would be given by some sort of integrated force on the particle.
That's a complete description now.
Yeah, it is some representation of the actual microscale physics. Yeah, so in other words, you take the microscale physics and you put down whatever you want. You have electrostatic forces, add whatever you want to physics. So that's your microscale physics embodied in the particle equation of motion.
That's what we had in Hermann's talk.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, okay, but it's on the wiki and that's what he did.
The parameters are settling velocity, the density parameter that I showed is written a slightly different way here, and the tau. So, you do some massaging and you can finally, the key result is this, there are two parameters, which is the, again here, in writing this I'm being sloppy, so what matters is that when I say small, I need to be a little careful. So this is a proxy for Stokes number and the non-dimensional settling velocity. So this is Stokes number and this is non-dimensional settling velocity. So you can come up with different regimes where settling effect is not very big, or settling effect is the order of the inertial effect, or settling effect is dominating inertial effect. So you can write particle velocity depending upon which regime you are as an expansion in terms of particle velocity. Again, the small parameters are these two, okay? And we have tested this. We have gone to higher order terms in tau, and the leading order approximation is V equal to U. And you know, if tau is small and you are in this regime, you could just take V equal to U plus Vs and stop at that. That's what the turbidity current does. But if you're not satisfied, if tau effects, inertial effects are important, you could use this. So it gives you a rational way of not having to solve your momentum equation for the particle, but yet justify an algebraic expression for your particulate velocity field. Okay.
You dropped the Bessel term.
In the leading order, it doesn't play a role, because to the leading order, one way to get this thing is to simply substitute this. In other words, so both the added mass and Bassett history to the leading order in tau do not play a role. Only what are called the Faxon correction plays a role. Mm-hmm. So this still will be valid for finite size particle. Right. But it to the leading order, both the added mass and Bassett history effects do not play a role. For example, you know, you think of like particles settling in a shear flow. You have exact solutions. So equilibrium order in approximation is simply one way to think of it, that all the transients have been killed. In other words, inertial effects, the history effects are not that important. So you can see the X component, the streamwise component of the particle is written in terms of the fluid velocity and its vertical gradient. And the vertical velocity is simply the settling velocity. So this is one application. Or you can think of a vortex, and you can calculate what the particle velocity in this vortex field, taking into account inertia without gravity in this case. Then you can get exactly what you would expect, the radial velocity of the particle in terms of the Stokes number, and also the circumferential velocity of the particle will slip and be different from the circumferential velocity of the local fluid because of the radial migration of the particle. So basically, these are the things you could come with the.
Are the Bassett forces ever important?
Not really. At this order tau, they are not important. Order tau, only the so-called pressure gradient force comes into play. So in other words, question like I said earlier, there is a pressure gradient. Fluid is responding and is accelerating at this value. Particles are not able to respond, and therefore there's a differential velocity will be of this part.
Do you assume they are not important, or did you test and show that they are not important?
This is solution of this equation of motion. Yeah, so this is exactly.
But did you check numerically that it is not really?
No, this is a formal expansion in small tau as a small parameter.
We did not test computationally. That are small terms.
Computationally?
My question is, you assume that Bassett forces, pressure gradient are small, but did you check that numerically?
Numerically, I will show you. Okay, numerically, what you think? We, in deriving this, I did not assume, so because they will appear in higher order terms, okay? To this order, it turns out, the leading order, Bassett history, and formally, asymptotic expansion doesn't give them.
Yes, that is what I understand.
So here is the test of what you asked. So this is an isotropic turbulent flow, particles are put in there, you track them using Lagrangian approach, taking whatever force terms, and then you use this equilibrium expansion that I showed here, and you compute particle velocity. And we've done a lot of different tests in isotropic turbulence, shear homogeneous turbulence, channel flow, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but it's, I think, a different test. Here you are comparing the Lagrangian Euler-Hermitian and in statistical sense, and then you see that apparently with the equations you implementing, it's fine.
Yeah.
But there are also papers available where people have added particles in vortex flows, and there you can show, when you include, for example, the other contributions, that you see effects. So depending on the situation you are considering, you may have effects of these other contributions in the Max-Reilly equation.
I didn't fully understand. So all we've done is take the turbulent flow, put particles, and solve their equations of motion.
Which one? Again, the one on the previous slide, or? Which equations now are you talking about that you solved?
This equation.
Here, or?
No, this equation.
This one, with the full equation. Okay.
Yeah. We have done a battery of tests. I don't remember exactly what we used in the other one.
Okay. For a small Stokes number and small settling velocities.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one way coupling, right? There's no effect back.
No back effect, nothing. Oh. Yeah. Just to test if Lagrangian tracking of particle where you solve the exact equations of motion versus with this approximation, how good it is. So that's a very fair question, and we have tested that. I don't have all the slides here because I knew I'm going to run over time, so, but I will give you all the references. Of course, as Stokes number increases, the difference increases and so on, but it's a very good approximation from our experience for Stokes number up to one. It does a fairly good job. Of course, there is no free lunch. As you increase and approach Stokes number equal to one, the differences get bad, and it's terrible when you want to apply this for very large Stokes number, because it just keeps linearly increasing, whereas in reality it doesn't happen that way.
And so, what term hurts you then, as the Stokes number increases?
For example, let's take this one. Say, for example, you take this and you take the divergence of particle velocity. Okay. So just I want to show that this expansion has a lot of interesting meaning, a physical contribution. So divergence of velocity, you will immediately derive this. So what this says is, even though your divergence of fluid velocity is zero, divergence of particle velocity is not zero, okay? That you will not get only with these two terms. That extra term comes from this, the fact that the particles are spun out of vortices, okay? So here you can see, this is well-known result, that the divergence of particle velocity is dictated by strain rate square minus vorticity, local vorticity, or rotation rate square. So particle, heavy particles, so beta is the density parameter. So beta less than one means heavy particles. So these particles congregate in high strain regions and avoid vortices. Whereas when beta is greater than one, the largest value beta is 3 when density ratio is 0. So there, particles will all migrate towards centers of vortices, which is bubbles and lighter particles. So
what beta did you use in this simulation?
What is that?
What beta did you use in this particular simulation? What value of beta did you use in this particular simulation?
Here, zero, I believe it is. Like I said, that this I'm just showing one sample.
No, I understand. I think.
Bubbles we have done also, but I don't have it here.
Beta equals zero is
heavy particles.
Extremely heavy particles.
So they are spun out of these vortex regions in this case. Answering your question, if you really do direct simulations tracking Lagrangian particles, divergence of particle velocity increases with tau, but it sort of saturates, okay? But here, when you use this for values of tau much larger than 1, it shows that the preferential concentration to linearly increase forever. Okay, so for very large Stokes number, if you just use this, you will predict unreasonably large accumulation of particles. Okay, so this works well for tau less than 1, but if it's too smaller, much smaller than 1, then there is no preferential accumulation either. Again, this is a different problem. Channel flow, near wall distribution of particles calculated using Lagrangian tracking.
And that means individual particles have been tracked? Is that so?
Yeah, millions of particles put one-way couple simulations. These particles are tracked in DNS of channel flow. So you can calculate the so-called exact particle motion against. Now again, this is done for different Stokes number and so on and so forth. I'm just showing example result.
All the Lagrangian ones, they have a finite size diameter.
No finite size.
Just point particles?
Point particles. This is one case, for example, gravity currents. This is no inertial effect, no settling velocity. Inertial effect, no settling velocity. Larger inertial effect, no settling velocity. And this is with settling velocity. You can see these things. So the important thing is that particles get spun out of vortices when you have inertial effect, and it does change the overall dynamics somewhat. So a little bit more at a later time, the same thing, three different inertia values for the particles. So we have done some simple gravity lock release problems, including the inertial effects. So quantitatively, three different inertial effects. And this is front velocity as a function of time. So you can see that the inertia a little bit increases the front velocity during slumping phase. Okay, it's a very short slumping phase because of the fact that the initial release was pretty small. We have looked at the effect of inertia on wall shear stress, and also looked at deposition. So in bottom line is that if inertia is important, even fairly small values of Stokes number, this is only 2%, does impact your wall shear stress, sedimentation patterns, and so on and so forth.
Is this in 2D?
This is in 2D.
And in 3D, you expect the effects to be similar, or is it again?
Not so similar, because it may be smaller, because of vortices are less active.
When you talk about deposition, did you take into account things like hindered settling, or sorry, did you just take the concentration times the settling velocity in order to get the sedimentation rate?
Sedimentation rate is just, concentration times settling velocity. Now the correction will go to zero on the wall, that inertial correction, because du dt is zero on the wall. So the inertial correction, this term, this additional term, it will become, we did not include this in that simulation, so we only use this leading order term, and this correction is zero on the wall. So on the wall, particle velocity is local fluid velocity, which is zero plus settling velocity. So
the effect is only due to what happened inside the flow, because more particles got...
Exactly. So the settling velocity at the wall, the deposition rate is altered by the change in concentration, not due to change in net settling. But away from the thing, you could have a net settling velocity. In fact, I did not show, you could do horizontal average of mean particle settling velocity. Okay. So horizontal average of U is zero in a channel, okay, by mass conservation. So with only this term, you can say that the mean settling velocity is simply this. But when you include this additional term, you can show that the settling velocity will increase by gradients of fluctuating vertical velocity. This is what my Greeks call as turbophoretic motion. So in other words, particles will migrate down the gradients of turbulent intensity. So there will be an enhanced flux of particles towards the wall. Should we stop there? Because I'm now.
Now you're going to start a new section.
I want to start. I have slides on particle turbulence interaction at the mesoscale, and also Jim, you wanted to know about resuspension of particles. So I have slides on lift forces and. So basically,
if we can do it, I would say do it. We agreed on 12:30, huh? So we have 15 minutes.
Okay. Okay, I'll quickly go through. So this slide, we don't need
sorry,
to talk
I have
about
a quick
this.
Question on the last slide on the deposit profile. If you go one more, yeah. So it has a lot of. Somehow nice periodic oscillation. Is it because of a near bed phenomenon or is it because some induced oscillation in the shear
these
layer?
These vortices, very coherent vortices, like Eckert talked about, they are not broken and they go and deposit. So this is just a demonstration problem we did many years ago. We did not pursue that because in the gravity currents that are meters big, this is not very important. Now, lately we are very interested in this because when you have wave-induced resuspension of particles, that Stokes boundary layer thickness is only centimeters or small, very small. And there, these inertial effects play a role. When we did this many years ago, we did not know all those problems. So we were thinking of in terms of turbidity currents. We just played with it to see what happens, what if kind of scenario. But honestly, in a meter scale turbidity current, this effect is not important,
right. Okay?
Because the tau will be very small, unless you have very large particles being suspended.
Okay. Another general question. If you compare with yesterday's equations, there is a diffusion term in the concentration equation that you don't have. So what is the difference? Because I think that we are pretty close in terms of the Stokes number and particle sizes today and with respect to yesterday's turbidity flows. So why is this term not necessary in your equation?
Diffusion term is necessary?
Why is it not?
Diffusion term we also use exactly the same way as he does.
But you do.
Oh yes.
So
in fact, it with inertial effects, it becomes even more important because as I argued, divergence of velocity is non-zero with inertia. That means particles, if you put them in a cellular flow, they will accumulate in regions. Okay, and therefore you can create concentration fronts. Okay, so it will increase the difficulty of simulating these flows with inertia. So diffusion is very much needed, and we do use that. And
but it's a numerical diffusion.
It is a numerical diffusion. But the right thing to do is that, like I said, since there is a scale separation in these problems, if it's there, then one needs to look at what is, you know, through a microscale simulation, what is the effective diffusion when you because of long-range interparticle interaction.
Didn't include it. I think
that
the
we
issue.
Did not. We, yeah. But we tried different diffusion terms, and Eckert argued correctly, nicely yesterday, that in these kind of flows, really diffusion is really active only in the very thin region. The overall dynamics, say for example, this plot and all, over a wide range of diffusion variations. In other words, we tested the sensitivity of these results.
But that's to numerical diffusion.
Yes, numerical diffusion. So within within a range.
Well, I just think we have to be careful to distinguish, because there's also physical diffusion that are due to various fluctuations in the problem that may or may not have to be incorporated in addition to the numerical diffusion.
No, I want to be very clear. This is not numerical diffusion in the sense of how we treat the numerics. So we explicitly add a diffusion term just like what he does. These are spectral simulations, so they are very low dispersive and diffusion, numerical diffusion and dispersion effect. So when I said yes, they are numerical, we have an explicit control over them, because just like what he does, we add a Schmidt number. So it is a modeled diffusion, okay? So we have a Schmidt number and a Laplacian of.
But do you say what the mechanism is that you're modeling? I thought it was simply to regularize fronts.
Yes, sir. That sense, they have been added only to regularize the front. Yes, sir. So it didn't come out of some micro scale average and say, yeah, this is the effective diffusion. Because that diffusion term will depend on local velocity and local volume fraction. And this is what I talked yesterday about sedimenting fronts. And there is some new knowledge, and we could do a better job in incorporating them in our diffusion.
Yeah, we did there not. Are physical mechanisms that are likely to give rise to those kinds of diffusion terms.
Yeah, we did not.
I just want to make certain that we're clear.
But see, typically when numerical diffusion, people talk, when they think in terms of not a diffusion term added to the governing equation, just the second order scheme diffusing, okay? That's not what we are doing. This is spectrally accurate simulation. So we explicitly put the diffusion term, and that is a crude model for whatever physics that's
there. Yeah, but that means that you are not taking into account any transfer of momentum that is also happening there. If there is some physics, there should be also diffusion of momentum that you are not taking into account. So what I'm saying, if you have some kind of process that is diffusing particles and moving particles from one place to another, they should carry some momentum. And there should be a momentum diffusion in the equation for the sediment that you are not taking into account.
We just have a diffusion term in the constant. I mean, this is exactly the same model that we showed.
But you have a diffusion term in the thing.
In the concentration equation, front.
But in the, I'm talking about the momentum equation. So for the, in the momentum equation for the sediment phase, you don't have a viscose type.
It's the Busenecq's model, where the density only plays a role in the buoyancy term. Mm-hmm.
Would it be of higher order? That's the kind of momentum diffusion, since you have small concentrations, and small diffusion means the concentration and small velocity differences. Yeah. So that should combine to be a very small term.
Yeah, so it will be a higher order. Yeah. Should be there, but it's not included because it's
negligible.
In the concentration equation, this diffusion is very important, because otherwise code become numerically very sensitive. The issue is this, if we don't have that, the particle concentration scales can become much smaller than the momentum scales. And we do not have the resolution. Our resolution has been set to resolve all of the velocity of the momentum scales. So when your particle front becomes subgrid scale, then in spectral method or in any other method, especially in spectral method, since there is no numerical diffusion mechanism, the code cries loud and blows up basically. So we need to sort of stabilize, and by invoking a Schmidt number one, what we are saying is that the concentration scales are not allowed to become smaller than your momentum scales. And usually that does not affect our overall results.
But there is some confusion, because a term like that appears in modeling sedimentation and turbulent shear flows, for example. and it comes from modeling the correlations between fluctuations in concentration and fluctuations in the fluid velocity. So, and there are different means of incorporating that correlation. Sometimes it's incorporated in the mass balance in a much the similar way that it appears in the turbidity current. Sometimes with Favre averaging, it appears in the momentum equation. So there's an issue.
Absolutely. This is exactly why I wanted to separate the scale-separated problem,
yes,
from a non-scale-separated problem. Because if the Stokes number is small, then, and since turbulence is fully resolved, okay,
exactly,
therefore there are no more fluctuations of the kind you're talking about. Now, when you are doing a large eddy simulation, either when you don't resolve all the eddies or when your particles are having multiple velocity, there are two different scenarios where you have velocities deviating from your mean value. Then that gives rise to fluctuating Reynolds stress, and then you have a closure in terms of diffusion like term. That is different from this. Okay, and that's why I wanted to sort those differences out.
Yeah. So it's really this, let's say there are modelers here and there are resolvers here. And it really is two different cultures. And some confusion results, I think, because of that.
Yeah, because you see this diffusion, that interparticle long-range interaction induced diffusion is constant volume fraction dependent and local velocity dependent, whereas the fluctuating quantities one could reasonably close with eddy viscosity kind of models, mm-hmm, where you write it in terms of gradients of mean velocity, where it has nothing to do with volume fraction. So there are different way you might model those diffusion terms arising from different mechanisms. In this part of the talk, what I wanted to talk about was turbidity current is a very interesting problem, because here the flow itself is due to suspended particles. So the suspended particles generate turbulence, and the turbulence resuspend particles, and this engine can reach a balance, okay? Or if resuspension exceeds sedimentation, then you can have a runaway kind of current. Or when sedimentation is above resuspension, you can have a current dying. So this complex interaction is sort of additionally disturbed by this stable stratification, because the concentration of the particle is large, and then it goes down. So you have stable stratification, which can also damp turbulence. So the suspended particles, on one hand, help turbulence, on the other hand, kill turbulence. So one of the things that we have explored in our simulations, we have considered different kinds of problems, and we find that under certain conditions, this can dominate the buoyancy effect, and turbulence can be completely shut out. Again, this is the model, exactly the same as what Eckert showed, so I'm not going to worry about this. The parameters are Reynolds number, our simulation DNS, this value will be at most few hundred, whereas in reality it's several hundreds of thousands, or millions and even more. The Schmidt number is, we talked about that, it's there to regularize the concentration fronts. And the Richardson number, which is a ratio of buoyancy effects to the inertial effects. And then one other parameter is the settling velocity. The one thing I forgot to mention, I'm running out of steam, so I'm just going slow here. one of the things, a lot of work has been gone on in understanding the front of the current. We have also done this Lock-Willis problem. But really, in this problem, we wanted to look at this kind of a balance. We wanted to look at the body of the current as opposed to the head, because in a real turbidity current, the head goes over you in minutes, but what you really see is the body of the current for hours and hours. So we really wanted to have a mathematical model for the body of the current. So I didn't show the details. So we went through Gary Parker, myself, and Mariano Cantero. We had constructed a simple sort of a model where we can approximate the body of the current by using streamwise periodic boundary conditions and so on. And that's the contact that I'm going to talk about. So these currents will have no head.
What's U star here?
U star is the friction velocity.
Okay. Is it imposed pressure gradient?
No, this here, the pressure gradient is from the particles.
So the pressure is from the particles.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. If the settling velocity is very small, when the concentration is uniform, this is like a channel flow, okay, or open channel flow. But when the particles are moving closer to the wall, it's a very interesting channel flow problem where the driver is mostly at the bottom. So your streamwise pressure gradient is depth dependent. So the particle settling has two roles. One, in the streamwise direction, the pressure gradient, the streamwise pressure gradient is depth dependent. In addition, you have the vertical effect of this, which is the buoyancy effect, which appears through this term as the sort of damping turbulence. Okay.
Does the boundary condition mean that on the bottom you don't?
What is it?
The boundary condition you wrote? Is it only for top or also for bottom?
It's for the bottom also. Okay.
So
in other words, in the simple,
to leave the domain then, right?
So this is basically to conserve the net mass of particles inside. We can play with this. We can change it. This is a very simple model problem to study the interaction. So the key. Like I said, that we have done many different cases with different boundary conditions and so on, different contexts. But let me just show one case where we fit the Reynolds number, Richardson number. So here, Richardson number, interestingly, happens to be only dependent on the theta, because your particles both drive the flow and damp the flow. Okay, so the damping versus driving only depends on the slope, theta. So we fix the angle in this case to be 11, some degree, I guess this is 5 degrees. And the only parameter, the knob that we turned, was settling velocity. And the settling velocity we changed from 0 to 0.026. All these cases, six cases, the turbulence is somewhat changed a little bit, but not a whole lot. But then a very, very small increase, further increase in settling velocity, completely damps turbulence. So this is sort of like a reverse instability phenomenon that we observe. Just like an instability where flow is laminar and then instability kicks in at a certain Reynolds number, here the reverse happens.
CB and CD, what is again?
Bottom concentration,
okay.
And top concentration. Don't worry about it right now. Really, what I want you to focus is these things, URMS and WRMS for the first five cases, 0 to 5, not a whole lot affected, but then it's completely damped for. The sixth case with a little increase in settling velocity.
You only show the RMS values here. First, can you, for my understanding, what is the streamwise velocity doing in case six? Is there still streamwise velocity, or has it just stopped? So are we looking at a stable bed basically, or is there still a streamwise velocity which is equal, but without any turbulence? So if a laminar flow that is quick but without turbulence.
Yeah, this is that limit is a funny limit in our model problem, because in reality, if there is no turbulence, all the particles should settle down and there should be no flow. But in our case, there is a streamwise flow in the model problem. Okay, in reality, if you think of in a field case where a turbulent flow is coming, I'm going to later show that there is a turbulent flow coming and there is a let's say a slope break, a shallower.
So if I were to interpret this result, it's not necessarily that it's physically dense of turbulence in a flow that's still flowing, but it's just that the particles will have settled onto the bed, and in fact there will have been a stable bed without any flow over it, which is not necessarily immediately the same as a physical interpretation that the concentration has dampened the turbulence in the flow. And because this is a problem that I've been thinking about based on some of your publications on this.
Can we talk? Yeah, because I
is there still a velocity there? You're only
in this model, yes, but in different. Yeah.
But that's not, that doesn't make any physical sense with respect to the phenomenon.
Maybe it is not so, for during lunch to discuss.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the
exactly because we already the wise suggestion.
Good suggestion.
Okay.
Is everybody in agreement? Is it okay with you, Bala, if we interrupt you for a little while?
Yeah, that's good.
I really feel we need to do more to stimulate discussions here.